their terms in office. Raisi will take an oath of office in an inauguration ceremony at the Iranian Parliament, or Majlis, on Thursday. But his new government is set to face a series of challenges. First and foremost, Iran's economy needs urgent action and medium-term planning to grow. Cruel and illegal US sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic have severely hampered Iran's economic growth. Iran is also dealing with an unprecedented drought, which has negatively affected its energy production and its agriculture sector in certain parts of the country.
So Iran has survived the American sanctions. I think they can continue as long as they use imaginative ways of implementing the exchange of goods and services by different currencies or barter.
Raisi has pledged to prioritize Iran's domestic needs and combat poverty, unemployment, inflation, and corruption. But in order to achieve that end, a certain give and take on regional issues is necessary, and Iran can prosper by playing an even greater stability role commensurate with the country's pivotal position.
Well, in my view, I think President Raisi won't necessarily remove the sanctions, but what he will do is increase Iran's ability to circumvent them. It's possible, for example, to use other currencies than the United States dollar to pay for trading back and forth.
Raisi has vowed not to repeat his predecessor's mistake of putting nearly all the bets on the nuclear deal and the resolution of foreign-imposed sanctions. He said he will decouple his agenda from the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Raisi has called on the U.S. to live up to its nuclear deal obligations.
I think President Raisi is talking more about countries such as Iraq and Syria and Libya and Lebanon and neighboring countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. I think that relying on Saudi Arabia and Israel and the Gulf states is a non-starter.
Raisi has said time and again that his government will solidify the relationship between Iran and regional countries. He's described strong ties with Iran's neighbors as important for the economy.
A somber mood prevails in Japan as the nation marks the 76th anniversary of the United States nuclear attack on the city of Hiroshima. The horrific atomic bombing was carried out during the final stages of World War II in 1945. On August 6 that year, an estimated 140,000 people were incinerated immediately under a mushroom cloud or died in the following months. Meanwhile, Japan is preparing to honor the victims of America's second nuclear strike. The bombing of the city of Nagasaki a few days later left tens of thousands of others dead. Many decades have passed since the world experienced the horrors and pain of nuclear attacks. The world doesn't truly seem to have learned a lesson from the catastrophes. Atomic weapons still pose an existential threat to humankind. There have been international calls for the total annihilation of nuclear arms worldwide. But atomic arsenals are not being dismantled or even reduced in number. They are instead being expanded and upgraded regardless of the incredible dangers and costs. The United States, which is the only country to have used nukes against another nation, is ironically leading the race to develop new nuclear weapons and modernize existing ones. The U.S. has openly accelerated the costly modernization of the American arsenal. Figures show that in recent years, America has spent heavily on its nuclear weapons program, almost as much as all other spenders like China, Britain, and Russia combined. The costs of such modernization programs run into the tens of billions of dollars each year.
I know in the United States there are very strong lobby groups that are representing the weapons industry, groups that represent companies like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Honeywell, These are some of the large producers of nuclear weapons. And they lobby Congress to pass more money. And what we saw is it really doesn't matter who is in the White House.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on governments to make the goal of a nuclear weapons-free world a reality. The UN chief warned that the push by nuclear weapons states to modernize their atomic arsenals has sparked a new arms race.
The U.S. now says that it needs to modernize these nuclear weapons because it's facing the adversary of China. But this is ridiculous because China has very few nuclear weapons and a much smaller military than the United States in all aspects. And it's not a time to be fueling a new race for nuclear weapons. It's a time to be recognizing that the world needs to conserve its resources to put into things like healthcare, getting rid of COVID, those kind of things, the climate issue.
The situation has undermined global security, but nuclear armed states are reluctant to even discuss disarmament. It is ironic that most of the big spenders on atomic arms are permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. They are definitely not making the world a safer place by spending more and more on such weapons of mass destruction. The United States and Russia have over 90% of all nukes worldwide, with over 14,000 warheads. America has the biggest number of deployed warheads, with hundreds of them ready to be used. India, Pakistan, and North Korea also possess nuclear weapons, but have not joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Meanwhile, Israel, which developed nuclear weapons in the 1960s with Western assistance, is the only possessor of nukes in West Asia. Israel and its supporters have blocked all efforts meant to create a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region. Possessors of these weapons have defied international calls to disarm. Observers believe they are responsible for the persistent threat of nuclear war.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's top aide, Melissa DeRosa, said late on Sunday, 8th of August, that she had resigned, a move that came as the governor fought for political survival after a report from the New York State Attorney General concluded he had sexually harassed nearly a dozen women. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist, Luis Ferez Adorni. The piece is titled, Cuomo's top aide, Melissa DeRosa, resigns as he fights to survive. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's top aide, Melissa DeRosa, said late on Sunday, 8th of August, that she had resigned, a move that came as the governor fought for political survival after a report from the New York State Attorney General concluded he had sexually harassed nearly a dozen women. Her resignation meant that Mr. Cuomo, a third-term Democrat, lost one of his most loyal aides and trusted strategists while facing an imminent threat of impeachment in the state legislature, and calls to step down from a constellation of top officials in his own party, including President Joe Biden and the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Melissa DeRosa stood by the governor's side for years, even as his inner circle shrank in size and many of the top staffers who had helped first elect him back in 2010 left the administration. The state attorney general report found that Melissa DeRosa had spearheaded efforts to retaliate against one of the women who had spoken out publicly about her allegation in December. After becoming a fixture in Andrew Cuomo's coronavirus briefings during the pandemic, Ms. DeRosa also had come under fire earlier this year for her involvement in the administration's efforts to obscure the full extent of nursing home deaths, a matter that is under investigation by federal authorities and the state assembly. Melissa DeRosa, who is 38 years old, said in a statement on Sunday, "The past 2 years have been emotionally and mentally trying. It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve the people of New York for the past 10 years. New Yorkers' resilience, strength, and optimism through the most difficult times has inspired me every day," she said. "I am forever grateful for the opportunity to have worked with such talented and committed colleagues on behalf of our state." Her departure, though, sent shockwaves across Albany, as political observers rushed to decipher what her resignation meant for Andrew Cuomo's future. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has not left Albany since the report's release on Tuesday, as he conferred with advisers over how to proceed. Mr. Cuomo has denied touching anyone inappropriately and has said that some of the 11 women who accused him of harassment may have misinterpreted his jokes and hugs as improper. His lawyers have gone on camera to mount a rigorous defense describing the investigation by the state attorney general, Letitia James, as biased, rushed, and sloppy. Melissa DeRosa announced her resignation the night before an interview with one of Andrew Cuomo's accusers, Brittany Camiso, was scheduled to air on CBS's This Morning program. Ms. Camiso, an executive assistant who had remained anonymous until Sunday, accused Andrew Cuomo of assaulting her while they were alone in the executive mansion late last year, one of the most serious claims leveled against the governor. She filed a criminal complaint with the Albany County Sheriff's Department, raising the possibility that Andrew Cuomo could face criminal charges. As secretary to the governor, Melissa DeRosa was the most powerful appointed official in the state. When Mr. Cuomo appointed her to the post in 2017, she became one of the youngest people to hold that position and the first woman in the role. She joined the Cuomo administration in 2013 as communications director and was promoted 2 years later to Chief of Staff. The Attorney General's report painted an unflattering portrait of Melissa DeRosa and her role in fostering a toxic workplace and attacking the credibility of Lindsay Boylan, a former economic development official who had accused Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment last December. After Ms. Boylan posted her allegation on Twitter, Melissa DeRosa orchestrated an effort among state officials and outside allies to leak Ms. Boylan's personal records, which contained sensitive information, to undermine her credibility. She also helped draft, review, and circulate a disparaging letter that was never published, but nonetheless assailed Ms. Boylan's character. As part of those efforts, Melissa DeRosa also instructed a former staffer to call a female Cuomo staff member who had voiced support for Ms. Boylan on Twitter, mine her for information, and record the phone conversation, the report said. As Andrew Cuomo's right-hand woman, She was deeply involved in navigating the governor's priorities through the state legislature and helping Mr. Cuomo secure policies such as the $15 minimum wage and paid family leave. She was also chair of the New York State Council on Women and was vocal about women's reproductive issues. Melissa DeRosa was seen in the state capitol as a protective, fierce defender of Andrew Cuomo, known to treat officials and lawmakers with some of the intimidating and heavy-handed tactics for which her boss was known. The daughter of Giorgio DeRosa, an influential lobbyist, she was drafted to work for Andrew Cuomo after serving as chief of staff to Eric Schneiderman, the former state attorney general who resigned in 2018 after four women accused him of physical abuse. Melissa DeRosa was mentioned nearly 200 times in the state attorney general's 165-page report, most prominently for her role in handling Ms. Boylan's allegations. While the governor and Melissa DeRosa were traveling in a car, she said she told Andrew Cuomo, "I can't believe that this happened. I can't believe you put yourself in a situation where you would be having any version of this conversation." After confronting Andrew Cuomo, Melissa DeRosa said she got out of the car, which had stopped at a traffic light. Around the same time, a new policy was put in place to prohibit Andrew Cuomo from being left alone with young female staff members to protect him from allegations of harassment.
The first Thursday of August, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi was inaugurated as Iran's eighth president, marking a new chapter in the history of the Islamic Republic. The 60-year-old president has already signaled that he would continue talks to restore the country's 2015 nuclear deal with world powers from which the US unilaterally withdrew 3 years ago. In fact, he inherited a moribund deal. Many observers hoped to be resurrected much sooner. Many, but not Press TV. A sixth round of negotiations with the Iran nuclear deal signatories in the Austrian capital ended in June, after which Iran signaled that talks can only continue after Mr. Raisi assumes office. After so many talks, now it's become clear for everyone that both Tehran's and Washington's demands are at direct odds, and both may need to make major compromises for the talks to lead to an agreement again.
We still have serious differences with Iran with regard to returning to mutual compliance with the JCPOA. Our teams are going back for a seventh round of indirect negotiations in the coming days. We'll see if we can bridge the differences, but they're real, and we have to be able to bridge them.
And that's the trajectory Press TV had already projected, even when politicians had high hopes for the deal after Joe Biden took office in the United States. So on January 20th, 2021, the inauguration day of Joe Biden, then-Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called on the incoming U.S. administration to come back to the 2015 nuclear agreement and lift sanctions on Tehran as part of the Americans' commitments under the deal. With Biden in the White House, new rounds of talks kick-started in Vienna. The sticking point was now which side had to revive the nuclear agreement. Tehran demanded Washington first lift sanctions.
as it was Washington that had withdrawn from the deal, and Washington called on Tehran to first resume compliance with the deal. The new rounds of talks, however, brought in some fresh blood. The aim was reaching an agreement in 2 months.
We are closer to a deal than any time in the past, but it doesn't mean that we are there. The remaining job is still difficult and needs lots of, you know, efforts and you know, further talks. So we decided to cut negotiations here, go back home, not only for consultations, but this time for decision making.
While top diplomats promised quick progress in the negotiations, Press TV's informed source had another story to tell. It was too naive to assume hurdles would be removed just in the absence of the anti-Iranian president, Donald Trump. And more importantly, the issue was not just about who had to take the first step. On April 21st, briefing with a senior State Department official on U.S. engagement in Vienna regarding the Iran nuclear deal was hardly more than what the informed source had already told Press TV. According to the senior State Department official, there are still disagreements, and in some cases pretty important ones, on our respective views about what is required to, what is meant by, a return to full compliance. The official added, and the distance that remains to be travelled is greater than the distance that we've travelled so far, so we're not near the conclusion of these negotiations. The outcome is still uncertain. The Biden administration said it couldn't remove the sanctions the U.S. had to remove under the Iran deal and needed to review each and every one from scratch. In other words, after all direct and indirect talks, the two sides were back to square one as the American side insisted on sequencing the removal of sanctions and the Iranian side insisted on the removal of all sanctions at once. Just before the briefing with a senior State Department official, the informed source had told Press TV that only the removal of all sanctions together against Iran would save the Vienna talks. It is not acceptable to Iran to divide the sanctions into removable, non-removable, and negotiable. In Tehran, nothing will be accepted but the removal of all sanctions, including those related to the JCPOA, reimposed and relabeled during the Trump era, according to the informed source. Despite campaign promises made by now U.S. President Joe Biden to return to the deal, Washington's return to the deal has stalled, predicted by Press TV since almost the very beginning. Back then, Press TV's stance was almost contrary to what other major media outlets would take. For example, in February 2021, AP reported in its article, Biden repudiates Trump on Iran, ready for talks on nuke deal, that the Biden administration says it's ready to join talks with Iran and world powers to discuss a return to the 2015 nuclear deal in a sharp repudiation of former President Donald Trump's maximum pressure campaign that sought to isolate the Islamic Republic. Despite Biden's apparent attempts to distinguish his administration from Trump's, his promise to return to the deal was conditional, requiring Iran to recommit to the deal's conditions before the U.S. lifts sanctions, and only after additional conditions are discussed. And until then, sanctions and other mechanisms of political pressure will be applied to Tehran. In other words, Biden's policy is exactly the same policy pursued by the Trump administration. It's become crystal clear why the leader of the Islamic Republic has always warned of the Americans' unreliability. It is worth repeating that a 2009 policy paper produced by the Brookings Institution titled Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Toward Iran detailed plans to lure Iran in with a deal related to its nuclear technology, accuse Iran of rejecting it, and thus serving as a pretext for further U.S. aggression. The paper laid out how the U.S. could appear to the world as a peacemaker and depict Iran's betrayal of a very good deal as the pretext for an otherwise reluctant U.S. military response.
We have recently heard, including in this meeting, discouraging statements from a few council members pointing their fingers at the victim instead of demanding the culprit to act responsibly. They have deliberately ignored the fact that Iran's steps in ceasing implementation of some of its commitments are remedial in nature. They have called on Iran to come to full compliance with its JCPOA commitments as if it was Iran that withdrew from the JCPOA, as if it was Iran that reimposed or introduced countless inhumane sanctions with the publicly declared objective of starving an entire nation, as if it was Iran that brazenly threatened all states either to violate Resolution 2231 or face punishment, as if it was Iran that pursued maximum pressure policy, and as if it was Iran that made every attempt to kill the JCPOA and Resolution 2231 forever.
In 2009, when these words were originally published, it might have been difficult to imagine just how literally and overtly the U.S. would attempt to implement this ploy against Iran. Yet with hindsight, it is clear that the Obama administration offered this deal to Iran with full knowledge it would be betrayed in the near future, and was under Trump, with attempts to sabotage the deal further clearly underway by the Biden administration. While White House occupants have changed three times now, the belligerent U.S. policy towards Iran has been a fixture and faithfully pursued for over a decade now. And for over a decade now, Press TV, as an informed, knowledgeable observer, has been exposing the Americans' dishonesty, hypocrisy, and double standards, not only in the Iran nuclear deal, but over a wide range of other issues the Americans have disgracefully been involved in.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the limelight.
August 9th was the 76th anniversary of the attack that struck the Japanese people in a matter of 3 days, claiming hundreds of thousands of innocent victims and almost permanently contaminating the soil and water resources of the unsuspecting cities. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Keihan International. This article is published under the heading Crying Need for Nuclear Disarmament. Stay tuned, please, for the details. August 9th was the 76th anniversary of the attack that struck the Japanese people in a matter of 3 days, claiming hundreds of thousands of innocent victims and almost permanently contaminating the soil and water resources of the unsuspecting cities. It is the day on which, in 1945, when the Second World War was virtually over with troops of Imperial Japan on full retreat from all war fronts, Nagasaki was targeted with an atomic bomb. Following a similar attack wrought on Hiroshima on August 6th. Who was the culprit? Or more properly, the terroristic regime that slaughtered the Japanese men, women, and children, and even animals on a large scale. History's most evil power, of course, which still continues its crimes against humanity all over the globe, through not just poking its dirty nose in the affairs of world countries, never letting them live in peace and security, but experimenting with more deadlier nuclear warheads that make the little boy and fat man dropped respectively on the two Japanese cities look insignificant. The United States of America is without the least doubt the incarnation of the devil, or else the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, would not have branded it the Great Satan. This satanic clique in Washington abhors disarmament of any weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, biological, and resorts to every pretext to build and stockpile devices that could blast the world to bits by wrongly accusing other countries of breaching what it calls international laws. As a matter of fact, the sadistic Yankees are the main violators of international laws and multinational accords. A glaring example is the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, which the U.S. forced upon the Islamic Republic in Geneva in 2015 regarding Iran's right to use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, and then, after removing only a few and not all of its illegal sanctions, breached it by withdrawing completely from it. It wasn't an accord at all, and only a blackmail to release part of Iran's own frozen assets, in view of the fact that the United States regime or any of the other five major nuclear armed powers to the talks which forced Iran to reduce its uranium enrichment right to a mere 3.5% from 20% purity and close down some nuclear installations, never gave any concessions to reduce their own doomsday arsenals. Let us forget this nightmarish experiment and learn an unforgettable lesson from it that on no account, whatever the magnitude of the crisis, national prestige and Islamic dignity should ever be mortgaged in exchange for a paltry sum. It is now time to look to the future that warrants coordinated efforts by the free world, not just for removal of any illegal American sanctions or any world state, but for forcing the U.S. and other nuclear armed states to dismantle their WMDs in order to make the world free of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons. As a remedy to this inhuman issue, we don't need deterrence that may lead to mutual assured destruction of any region or the whole world. What we require in this age of cyberspace and artificial intelligence is to explore the undiscovered vistas of modern science to develop the technology for neutralizing nuclear weapons, if not making them totally useless, so as to prevent any such attack by devils in human form as the satanic U.S. had wrought on Japan in 1945 through its atomic terrorism on a mass scale, and refuses to admit its crimes against humanity.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, has encouraged both the people and officials to carefully observe the health protocols for the prevention of COVID-19 from the early days of the outbreak. In addition, he himself has obeyed the regulations enacted by the National Committee on combating corona even more than others. Moreover, His Eminence has reminded both the people and officials of the necessity of observing the enacted rules in various speeches. Insistence on observing the health protocols during Muharram mourning ceremonies. I wish to say something about Muharram. There are many debates about Muharram. People have been speaking about Muharram for a long time. Well, they will hold the mourning ceremonies one way or another. But what I want to stress is that in mourning ceremonies, the main criterion is what medical experts, the National Anti-Corona Headquarters, announce to us. I myself will observe whatever action they deem necessary. My firm recommendation to all those who wish to participate in the mourning ceremonies, including mourning committees, those who take the minbar, the organizers, panegyrists, performers of elegies and like, is this: before you do anything, you should see what they say. If the National Anti-Corona Headquarters issue certain regulations for these occasions, all of us will have a duty to observe them. The issue is not a minor issue, rather it is a very important one. In the present time, there is supervision and control to some extent. However, if God forbid, these measures are taken lightly and if people do not observe them, then there will be a disaster with unclear consequences at the end. July 31st, 2020.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September 27th, 2017.
The next point is that I strongly ask all the organizations in the country to cooperate responsibly with the Ministry of Health, which is in the front line of confronting this disease, and to provide it with all resources and amenities. Of course, I have also asked the armed forces and the organizations which are in contact with my office to provide the people with all their resources in this regard. March 3rd, 2020. Of course, countries have different performances in managing coronavirus. Not all countries are the same, Some countries, such as the U.S., whose management is among the worst ones on this matter, have had the worst management, and some are in a better condition. We should try to exercise the best management so that we can pass through this event. This is a very important event. October 24th, 2020.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the world with reporters.
The Afghan Defense Ministry has confirmed the fall of Shibirghan, Kunduz, and Saripul cities in northern Afghanistan into the hands of the Taliban, saying Afghan troops backed by local armed forces have retreated as an attempt to avoid civilian casualties.
In the meantime, the Defense Ministry also says that government troops backed by local armed forces are planning to conduct a large-scale attack on the captured cities to retake them from the Taliban. A move that, according to military commanders, needs more time.
In such circumstances, locals here look to the ongoing war as unfruitful. They urge the Afghan government, the Taliban, and the rest of local players to set aside their differences for the sake of people's demand, which is peace and calm.
None of the foreign players can bring a lasting peace to Afghanistan in the absence of a strong unity among us, especially among main players such as the government and the Taliban. They must set aside their differences and work for the sake of people while not relying on foreigners, mainly the U.S.
Many others also believe that there are some secret dealings behind the recent rising Taliban advances. That is why they want some international bodies, mainly the UN, to intervene in an effort to end what they call a proxy war in Afghanistan.
We, the people of Afghanistan, have realized that there are some dirty foreign hands involved in the rising war and bloodshed in our country. That's why we call on the United Nations to intervene and convince the backers of the conflict to stop their proxy wars in Afghanistan.
The Taliban has expanded its attacks over the recent month, capturing over 200 districts in different parts of the country. The militants are gaining more ground despite suffering heavy casualties during their assaults, mainly on big cities. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Prisoners' Committee for the National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip is holding a series of events, including an international campaign demanding an end to the illegal policy of administrative detention practiced against Palestinians in Israeli jails. The protest was held in front of the headquarters of the International Committee of the Red Cross that came along with a conference in the West Bank.
Detainees under the administrative detention don't have any charge and they don't know why they are arrested. They can't have a lawyer and they don't know when they are going to leave the jails. There are detainees who spent more than 10 years with no legal charge. Most administrative detainees are on a hunger strike defending their right to freedom. We are holding a campaign to tell the detainees that they are not alone.
The illegal administrative detention policy allows the Israeli regime to extend the detention of a prisoner without charge or trial and prevents them from having a lawyer.
Today, Palestinians are protesting here against the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention practiced against our people with no charge. Supporting the Palestinian detainees and their issue is a priority for us. We call on all human groups to stand by the detainees and bring an end to Israel's administrative detention.
Since the beginning of August, 17 Palestinian detainees have begun a hunger strike to protest against their administrative detention. Palestinians have called on the international community to break its silence over the prisoners' issue and stop the illegal policy to save the lives of Palestinian prisoners.
The administrative detention policy totally contradicts international law and violates human rights. I personally was suffering from this illegal policy for 3 years inside Israeli jails, and I can tell you the tragedy administrative detainees live with. Being arrested with no charge and having no court for an unknown number of years are what administrative detainees suffer from. Unfortunately, the human rights groups and the international community are aware of this tragedy, but don't move a stone.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees, who are arrested with no charge amid the silence of the international community. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
On
Under the title, The Blockade and Raising Customs Tariffs is an American Crime, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a to stand against the recent decision of the former President Hadi government to raise the customs tariff by 100% on the imports to Aden Port amid the continued closure of Hodeidah Port by Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis came out to the streets today to tell the whole world that raising the customs tariffs and the financial and economic siege on Yemen must come to an end. Yemenis have been steadfast for years and will prove to the world that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders militarily and economically.
Protesters said the new tariff rate will negatively affect the prices of basic commodities, including food and medicine, amid the already dire humanitarian situation due to the ongoing Saudi war and siege.
Raising the prices of customs tariffs will negatively affect the prices of foodstuffs and all other basic commodities. And this is unacceptable. We are living the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and this decision will constitute an additional crisis in light of what we have been experiencing for 7 years.
They have also said the U.S. and the Saudi-led coalition imposed this new tariff rate to force Yemenis to surrender after they have failed in the military field.
The aim of the decision to raise the tariff is to force the Yemenis to surrender. But our principles and morals reject this, and we will continue our steadfastness until we achieve victory. The enemies have failed to defeat us through creating difficult economic situation for us.
Yemen is on the brink of famine and facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, since the Saudi-led coalition backed by Washington launched a devastating war on the war-ravaged nation at the beginning of 2015.
People here say that Washington is back in the Saudi siege, which is threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children. They say the continued apathy of the international community is yet another proof of the U.S. participation in the brutal war on their country.
The South Korean government extended its highest level of social distancing for 2 more weeks as new cases of COVID-19 drag on at over 1,500 per day, the most since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020.
The speed of the ongoing outbreak is slowing, but the size of the outbreak is still big, and this shows it's unclear if the outbreak will display a downward trajectory soon. The movement of people is not decreasing as much as desired, and the Delta variant cases continue to increase.
The more contagious Delta variant of the virus is responsible for more than half of the new cases. Private gatherings of more than 2 people after 6 p.m. are banned, and nightlife is largely shut down. The South Korean government had just announced the relaxation of social distancing guidelines when the fourth wave struck here in early July, forcing officials to reverse course. And pressure now is mounting for relief. Churches have been critical over restrictions on the number of people that can attend services, and unions have held large street rallies challenging the guidelines. Although most people observe government advisories, frustration is growing.
The level of social distancing has been increased and decreased and increased again. Personally, I think that social distancing has no point because it's nonsense. We are now in level 4 of social distancing, but the number of new cases has not decreased.
Officials say measures will be relaxed when case numbers fall. South Korea has so far vaccinated about 15% of the population, with the government now considering booster shots for those most vulnerable. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, said that the recent Israeli attack was a very dangerous development, which has not occurred in the last 15 years, stressing that the resistance needed to respond swiftly.
Our response was linked directly to the two incidents of Israeli Air Force attacks, which targeted Lebanese territory for the first time in 15 years. And our response had very clear tools and objectives. We calculated our moves very precisely. Our enemy and our friend said this. They said open territory. They did not target civilians. So we also targeted open areas with no civilians. But we had many options. We could hit open areas in Sheba Farms, in northern occupied Palestine, or the occupied Golan Heights.
Said Hassan Nasrallah made the remarks in a televised speech to commemorate the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war. He said that Israel deliberately targeted open areas in the middle of the night in order to terrorize civilians, and presumed that the resistance would not respond because of the various domestic problems inside Lebanon. Said Nasrallah stressed that the main deterrence for Israel is the capabilities of the resistance.
The enemy today is more fearful than any time in the past because of the developments in Palestine and the region and the transformations in the region and the ascending strength of the resistance and because of the deep internal divisions and the mutual hatred between the occupying Zionist groups. Facing their internal issues and the strengthening of the resistance, everyone in the Zionist entity is talking about an existential threat.
Experts believe the military potential of Hezbollah has created a balance of deterrence where Israel is incapable of even starting a war.
Israel wants Hezbollah to start the war. The situation will be different. Hezbollah is aware of this, will not Israel let him go to war, anytime Israel wanted.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance noted that in any future confrontation, the Israeli military will disintegrate completely and would be heavily defeated. The 2006 war had settled a certain status quo, which remains until today, with a new regional equation, which comprises all the resistance groups in the region. Any miscalculation by the Israelis could be detrimental for Israel. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Visiting the famous Eiffel Tower in Paris has become more complicated than before. Now, people have to show an electronic document that proves that they are vaccinated twice. If not, they need to show a negative PCR test. However, most of the visitors do not consider this procedure as a problem.
It's a good opportunity to show that you're vaccinated. For me, this is perfect. This way, we are all sure that we are vaccinated.
I'm fine with it. I mean, if it lets us do things like this, then why not? To go back to some kind of normal, being able to spend time with our family, go on vacation, it's nice.
The same procedure is used to visit public places like the Louvre Museum. Rows are longer than usual because people have to show their pass.
I'm rather in favor of the health pass. If it is to protect everyone and to prevent the virus from spreading, that's better for everybody.
The French Parliament and Senate have voted this new law, and earlier this week, the Constitutional Council has approved the law text. The health pass will now be extended also to restaurants and trains. But protesters continue taking the streets. They were again tens of thousands in France and at least 2,000 in Paris. Why? Jerome Rodriguez, who lost his eye in a previous protest, organized this march. He explains that the problem is not the vaccination, but the limitation of liberties.
We are here to protest against the violation and decline of liberties in France. We are not here against the vaccines. The health pass is just one extra restrictive law after another. The first restrictive law was against the Yellow Vests, the second one about global security, and now the third with the health pass. Macron should take care of the poor people, not only of the rich companies who earned a lot of money during this COVID crisis.
The protesters are especially targeting the French government that is using force rather than persuasion to obtain a double vaccination of a large majority of the French. The reason is medical. Today, most of the people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID-19 virus are not vaccinated. Most of the people who transmit the virus are not vaccinated either. Despite ongoing protests against the mandatory health pass, the majority of the French is bowing more and more to the medical evidence. Today, vaccination is the only efficient way to hold back the coronavirus. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
This is Pin Baldak, a Afghan border crossing in southwest of Pakistan. North Taliban have shut it down, demanding Pakistan a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens. The complete closure of the border has suspended transportation of edible items and movement of thousands of people from both sides. The Taliban recaptured most of the border crossing with the neighboring countries of Afghanistan in an attempt to lay down a besiege of President Ashraf Ghani's beleaguered government in capital Kabul. Islamabad has completed 90% of wide fence of nearly 2,700 kilometer long porous border with Afghanistan to contain the movement of terrorists sneaking into Pakistan to carry out terrorist attacks. If visa restriction is removed, Islamabad fears there would be more infiltration of terrorists into Pakistan. Therefore, the government here is unlikely to concede to the Taliban demand of a visa-free movement of Afghan citizens.
It's not a legitimate government who can come up with a legitimate demand, or where it can ask a relationship which is based state to state. It has to legitimize itself. It has to bring itself to an acceptable and internationally recognized position.